You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Genesis 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was formless and empty, and darkness covered the deep waters, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the surface of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good. Then he separated the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, the darkness night, and the evening passed and morning came, making the first day. That expression, evening passed and morning and evening, it sounds like a literal day, doesn't it? When God said, "Let there be a space between the waters to separate the waters from the heavens and the waters of the earth," and that is what happened. God made this space to separate the waters of the earth from the waters of the heavens. God called the space sky, and evening passed, and morning came, marking the second day. This goes on for 6 days total, the 6 days of creation. Then on the seventh day, God rests. So we'll be looking at the text a little bit more as we go on here. One of the things we need to know right up front is that there's not just one way to read this narrative, and there are different interpretations. Tonight, we'd like to go through three model conceptions of how we got here and why, you know, what led up to it. First would be theistic or atheistic evolution, the belief that natural cause and effect, random events, pure chance has resulted in what we see here. And then there's progressive creation, the belief that God created, but not in one act, actually in multiple acts of creative intrusion, and perhaps combined with evolutionary processes in addition, so that it's both things. And then mature creationism is the view that is very plain sense reading of this passage, and it's like this is when God created the earth. It took 6 days, and it's not just the earth. They believe that the whole universe came into being at this point, very contrary to natural history, very contrary to cosmology today. So, let's take these on. Theistic or in theistic evolution, they believe exactly the same thing that the atheist evolutionary people believe, except they say God had fashioned the setting, the bases for it, and the way he created the universe, and knew that this would happen, and really that, you know, may have guided the process at certain points, but that it's basically working on its own. Major problems with this point of view. The first would be what we call abiogenesis. That is original life, the first life form, going from non-living compounds to a living organism. It's a huge question that I think will never be satisfactorily answered by the materialistic worldview. And I hope I can explain why I feel that way tonight. Under this, the original living organisms had to arise purely by chance reactions between non-living chemicals, molecules. So that living molecules, or, you know, inanimate molecules, gave spontaneous rise to life because they were bouncing off one another and reacting, forming different compounds. Yeah, I just don't think that that is possible at all. First of all, no one has really suggested a realistic mechanism for this. A lot of the types of reactions needed to form the polypeptides, the proteins that make up life, are counter-advantageous. They are uphill thermodynamically. They won't happen unless something catalyzes them to make it happen. And so it's just unimaginable how we could get to original life just on its own, life arising by itself. Remember, natural selection, evolution cannot be invoked at this stage. That is only possible after you already have self-replicating organisms that can get mutations and can either survive or not survive, depending on whether it's advantageous. But that's after life is already existing. We're saying, how did it get started in the first place? People say, oh, the Miller-Urey experiment where they had ammonia and some other gases in a bell, and they flashed electricity through it, and amino acid goop formed on the sides of the bell. And people are like, see? They assembled themselves, so just extrapolate that on out, and you got it. Actually, you don't have dick. For one thing, they set that experiment up knowing that that would happen and putting gases in the bell that were not the gases you would find in a primordial Earth. Of course, primordial atmosphere is different than our atmosphere today, but it was not what they put in. And an amino acid is a simple compound, very simple. These are the building blocks of proteins, but proteins will use thousands sometimes of amino acids to form one protein molecules. So, you know, you can imagine getting a big pile of stones, putting some dynamite under it, you blow it up, it goes up and it falls down. It's not going to fall into the Taj Mahal, right? That's just never going to happen. No matter how many times you blow it, repeat the experiment, those patterns of random scattered rock are going to continue to look very similar every time. And it's never going to change. It's never going to turn into a building like that. And if someone's over here and saying, look here, here's one stone on top of another, that proves this will work eventually. It's not going to work. That proves nothing. And this is basically what that Miller-Urey experiment is like. It's just not relevant to the whole, to the big picture, because all they're doing is producing a couple of simple compounds. This formation of life, based on chance and unguided, so improbable that it is, I think, impossible. Let's watch this little flick on how transcription works.
What you are about to see is DNA's louder. Most extraordinary secret. How a simple code is turned into flesh and blood. It begins with a bundle of factors assembling at the start of a gene. A gene is simply a length of DNA instruction stretching away to the left. The assembled factors trigger the first phase of the process, reading off the information that will be needed to make the protein. Everything is ready to roll. 3, 2, 1, go. The blue molecule racing along the DNA is reading the gene. It's unzipping the double helix and copying one of the two strands. The yellow chain snaking out of the top is a copy of the genetic message, and it's made of a close chemical cousin of DNA called RNA. The building blocks to make the RNA enter through an intake hole. They are matched to the DNA, letter by letter, to copy the A's, C's, T's, and G's of the gene. The only difference is that in the RNA copy, the letter T is replaced with a closely related building block known as U. You are watching this process called transcription in real time. It's happening right now in almost every cell in your body.
Holy cow. Did you see how fast that thing would race along? And it's creating, of course, a carbon copy of the DNA, which then goes out of the nucleus of the cell, and into a cluster of, like a factory-like gathering of of proteins, enzymes, which then execute whatever's on that strand. And that is called translation. Okay.
When the RNA copy is complete, it snakes out into the outer part of the cell. Then, in a dazzling display of choreography, all the components of a molecular machine lock together around the RNA to form a miniature factory called a ribosome. It translates the genetic information in the RNA into a string of amino acids that will become a protein. Special transfer molecules, the green triangles, bring each amino acid to the ribosome. The amino acids are the small red tips attached to the transfer molecules. There are different transfer molecules for each of the 20 amino acids. Each transfer molecule carries a three-letter code that is matched with the RNA in the machine. Now we come to the heart of the process. Inside the ribosome, the RNA is pulled through like a tape. The code for each amino acid is read off, three letters at a time, and matched to three corresponding letters on the transfer molecules. When the right transfer molecule plugs in, the amino acid it carries is added to the growing protein chain. Again, you are watching this in real time. And after a few seconds, the assembled protein starts to emerge from the ribosome. Ribosomes can make any kind of protein. It just depends what genetic message you feed in on the RNA. In this case, the end product is hemoglobin. The cells in our bone marrow churn out 100 trillion molecules of it per second.
What?
And as a result, our muscles, brain, and all the vital organs in our body receive the oxygen they need.
Did she say 100 trillion per second? She did. That is unfreaking believable. You know, all life is extremely complex like this. We're just focusing on one area here with DNA transcription and translation. But there are another dozen processes that we could look at. You know, to be alive, you have to be able to take in food and metabolize it, turn it into energy, turn it into protein. Fats, you have to be able to reproduce. Another vista there. People will say, well, yeah, I mean, life is very complex today, but it's had a long time to develop. Obviously, the first life would be much more simple than that. That's really problematic because we don't find any examples of simpler life. This mechanism, this collection of machines that we just looked at, is there for every living thing. Now, when you look at these two pictures, most people agree that the one on the left could be designed, maybe it was carved a long time ago, but the one on the right definitely was. There's no question about that. Okay? How do we know? How do we know intuitively that this is obviously man-made? If you've never seen it before, you would know that the minute you looked at it. Well, one point is the specificity. On the one on the left, kind of looks like a dude or something from one angle. The one on the right looks exactly like people from any angle. It's way more specified. And so we can recognize design when we see it, especially when it's really extreme. And, you know, not just a design in the sense of piling a few blocks on top of each other, but something really like this. I mean, there's just no way. But there's more, okay? When we find out that these faces on the right closely resemble different American presidents, now your chance of it being a natural formation, an act of erosion, go down to zero, because it is referring to something outside of itself that can never happen under any circumstances unless an intelligent planning entity, sculptures, whatever they're called, injects information and intent from the outside. Okay, so the analogy here that we're making is that when we go to the cell, to life, we are seeing this kind of extra-referential symbolism. John Lennox calls this a semiotic, from semia, symbol, a sign. So having to do with like language or a code, like a computer program code would be semiotic. And anytime, anywhere that we find something that is semiotic, that has a message that is referring to outside of itself, this is never there unless it was placed there by intelligent beings, usually us. In the cell, we have something not just as obvious, but way more obvious. The complexity that we're talking about in this mechanism is more extreme than anything humans have ever created. Miniaturized to an amazing degree, totally effective. And yes, it can evolve too. That doesn't lower the picture at all. That actually makes it even more amazing. These reactions are so complex that, you know, we have never come anywhere near to fabricating any of these molecules. And of course, as far as the system goes, notice here on the right transcription, the ribosome is reading the code and then summoning the transport molecules and attaching the right amino acid. And yet, as complex as that is, this is what a ribosome looks like. Thousands of atoms in this, all perfectly arranged, and does this amazing task. But it itself is totally incapable of producing a protein or doing anything. It has to have instructions from the DNA. The DNA can give out instructions, but it can't execute those instructions. It has to have the ribosome for that part. So what do we have here? We have extra referentiality at a dazzling level, and also an irreducibly complex system, because they both have to be there at the same time. So both of these would have to happen by accident and show up. No freaking way. Lennox is a professor of math at Cambridge. He says there's a chasm as vast and absolute as it is possible to conceive between human machines and life. He says even the tiniest of bacterial cells, weighing less than a trillionth of a gram, is a veritable micro-miniaturized factory containing thousands of exquisitely designed pieces of intricate molecular machinery, made up altogether of 100,000 million atoms. This is in the smallest bacteria that we know. So it's 100 billion atoms in one cell. Far more complicated than any machine built by man, and absolutely without parallel in the non-living world. Never find anything like this anywhere except in life. He says molecular biology has also shown us that the basic design of the cell system is essentially the same for all living systems on Earth, from bacteria to mammals. In all organisms, the roles of DNA, mRNA, and protein are identical. The meaning of the genetic code is also virtually identical in all cells worldwide. Oh, well, now that doesn't really fit the atheistic evolutionary model when you think about it. When you think of the variety of life on Earth, you know, from a worm to an elephant, I mean, everything in between, all of them use exactly the same code, exactly the same mechanisms. They have the same molecular machines, factories, really, within them. Why wouldn't there be different codes arising? Why, you know, different parts of the world? People who believe life arose spontaneously usually hold that it was in a vast prebiotic soup that was rich in organic molecules, and that it's just starting to arise all over the place. And how could that be? They all have exactly the same. They all came from one place. That's obvious. Either from one place, or indeed made by one designer. That would explain right there. He says, quotes Nobel Prize winner Jacques Monod, who was got the Nobel Prize for discovering how enzymes are fabricated in the cell. Monod says, "We have no idea what the structure of a primitive cell might have been. The simplest little living system known to us, the bacterial cell, in its overall chemical plan is the same as that of all other living beings. It employs the same genetic code, the same mechanism of translation as do, for example, human cells. Thus, the simplest cells available to us for study have nothing primitive about them. No vestiges of truly primitive structures are discernible." And so this, I think, is a real blow to the view that this just happened, because why wouldn't we have primitive, primordial, simple? It's what we have here has the marks of design all over it, and not just any design, but a fabulously brilliant design, amazing design. No, it cannot happen by accident. Some of the opponents, defenders of naturalistic origin of life, roll out a theory. It's probably the most followed theory today, which they call the RNA world theory. And this RNA, which is just like DNA, except it's only half, it's one side of the DNA. Very complex. That there was RNA strands floating around, and they found that the RNA also has an enzyme on the bottom, so it can catalyze reactions. So what we just need is for the RNA to duplicate itself. And then imagine that just keep happening, and somehow it congeals. There's a to get a cell wall, maybe they got inside of a bubble in mud, and we see these mud bubbles. Okay, that could be the beginning of a cell wall. Oh man, this is so much in the hurt box. First of all, RNA doesn't just show up, okay? RNA is produced in the cell, the same way the other proteins are. And it's also tends to break down quickly in water. It reacts with water. Why would there just be all these RNA cells and they don't replicate themselves? They take the message to the ribosome, which replicates. So anyway, whatever we're talking about here is pure imagination. Never seen anything like that. Even when origin of life scientists have tried to ingest huge amounts of the necessary compounds in concentrations that never would have happened in real nature, they still can't get anything to happen. This guy, Jack Stostat, if you go to YouTube and just search for him, this lecture series, three lectures. He's the Harvard MD and research scientist who is heading up a nationwide funded project on discovering the origin of life on Earth. I came across this a year or two ago, and I thought, well, this will be interesting. Hope it doesn't rock me too bad. Oh, I think you'll see for yourself. It's really, it's kind of sad. And including, you know, category errors, where he'll show how life has adapted to acidic areas, to base areas, frozen, you know, at the poles, bottom of the ocean, and so on, how life can just do anything. And, you know, so, but that's a different category, right? Once you're alive and reproducing, yeah. But we're asking about the origin of life. But I think he brings that in as kind of setting up the audience to be like, yeah, basically life can do anything. And they overlook the fact that, oh, wait, there's no evolution here. There's no natural selection possible. And see what you think. I was not too impressed with this series of lectures. I really don't believe this. Organisms arising by chance reactions between non-living cells. I cannot believe that, especially what we know now, which is growing, ballooning over the past couple or three, four decades, discovering how these mechanisms work. We had never had any idea that it was that complex. And to imagine that that happens by accident is just really kind of crazy, I think. There's other arguments against this too. The notion of irreducible complexity, I just mentioned one where you have to have both the DNA, the RNA, and the ribosome. All three are needed. It's not, having two of those won't do anything. You have to have all three. That's irreducible complexity. In natural selection, there are mutations that give you a slightly different trait, very slight. And that mutation will be saved, and natural selection will select for that organism if the mutation gave it an advantage for survival. But if there's no advantage conferred, then it will disappear. And it won't. Natural selection is not what they call teleological, where you know where this is going to end up, so therefore you take the steps to get there. Nothing like that when it comes to natural selection. It is completely, has no idea what's going on, and it's pure survival. If, though, having half of an eye still can't see, but you've made terrific progress, it confers no survivability on you. Why would it then continue to develop? And there have to be so many steps, sometimes millions of steps, involved in developing key biological sections in human bodies. The fossil record is also a problem for this theory, because under pure Darwinian evolution, you would expect to see an extremely gradual, very slow advancement and morphing from one species to many species. And that's not what we see in the fossil record. Instead, when we look at the fossil record, it doesn't look like that. It looks more like this, where there's different quantum level leaps upward, and the part in between is missing. This is really what we see in the fossil record. Massive numbers of species coming into existence, no predecessors of any kind, whole new orders. They survive and continue through the fossil record, sometimes for millions of years, relatively unchanged. And then they maybe disappear. So this is really not what you would expect to see. And I'm going to pick out one of these dramatic discontinuities tonight and talk about the Cambrian explosion, which is probably the worst one of these. Matthew Wills talking about the Cambrian fossils in Science Daily. The fossils from the Cambrian period can cause a real headache for evolutionary biologists. Instinct tells us to expect simple organisms evolving over time to become increasingly more complex. However, during the Cambrian period, there was an apparent explosion of different major groups of animals all appearing simultaneously in the fossil record. How can that be? Natural selection takes millions of years to develop even a minor change, to go from single cell animals worldwide to a complete suite of all kinds of immense creatures up to 10 feet long, trilobites. Every phylum that we have today, almost every one, began at this time. It's about 500 and some million years ago. And it's almost like you have, since 3.8 billion years, you have single cell organism, and then all of a sudden, boom, and this explosion, and now you just have millions of examples of very advanced life forms. Gaylord Simpson, famous, prominent evolutionary fossil, is an expert on fossils. So the absence of traditional forms, transitional forms in the fossil record is true of all the 32 orders of mammals. The earliest and most primitive known members of every order already have the basic ordinal characteristics. And in no case is an approximately continuous sequence from one order to another known. Oh, and he says, in most cases, the break is so sharp and the gap so large that the origin of the order is speculatively and much disputed. This regular absence of transitional forms is an almost universal phenomenon, as has long been noted by paleontologists. It's true of almost all orders and classes of animals, both vertebrate and invertebrate, and it's apparently also true of an analogous category of plants. Discontinuity, not a smooth upward rise like you would expect. So we open our, you know, sixth grade science book, and it's got the tree of life here. Working on it. But again, this is kind of misleading, because what we actually have is this. All of the branches and things that tie them together are imagined. That's speculation. We don't actually have fossils showing that. Oh, before we go to the clip, yeah, Simpson goes on. He says he wonders whether maybe such major events, where we jump up to a higher level, take place instantaneously by some process essentially unlike those involved in lesser or more gradual evolutionary change. Some process makes it jump up. I got an idea what that might be.
To understand the speed of the Cambrian explosion, imagine the history of life compressed into a single day.
If we imagine the whole history of life on Earth taking place in one 24-hour period, the current standard estimates for the origin of life put it at about 3.8 billion years ago, let's say 4 billion. So if we start the clock then, our 24-hour clock, 6 hours, nothing but these simple single-celled organisms appear, the same sort that we saw in the beginning. 12 hours, same thing. 18 hours, same thing. 3/4 of the day has passed, and all we have are these simple single-celled organisms. Then at about the 21st hour, in the space of about 2 minutes, boom, most of the major animal forms appear in the form that they currently have in the present. And many of them persist to the present, and we have them with us today. Less than 2 minutes out of a 24-hour period. That's how sudden the Cambrian explosion was.
Since Darwin, excavations on every continent have revealed the magnitude of the explosion of life, an event that was clearly global in scope. In 1984, one of the most important finds in the history of paleontology was made outside a small town in China's Yunnan province. While surveying this mountain near Chenjiang, Hosien Guan unearthed Cambrian fossils older, more diverse, and better preserved than any ever discovered. The condition of the Chenjiang fossils was so remarkable, Ho said, it appeared as if the animals were alive on the wet surface of the mudstone.
The fossils they've collected, I mean, first of all, they're stunning. I mean, they're really beautiful to look at.
They're brightly colored, stained with iron and probably other kinds of minerals, so they're kind of golden looking or kind of reddish, and they really stand out from the rather tan colored background of the rocks, and they're just beautiful. So aesthetically, they're wonderful.
Many of them are soft bodied. No hard parts, no skeletons, no shells, just soft bodied, and yet they're exquisitely preserved. So you can see the Cambrian explosion in greater detail than you can anywhere else in the world.
The Chenjiang fossils drew the attention of scientists worldwide. People daily reported that this find actually challenges the theory of Darwin's evolution. And then towards the end of 95, Time magazine in the December 4th has this front cover story about animal Big Bang, which talk about Chinese great leap forward in science. Then really solidified my interest. I said, this is something really big. I want to get to the bottom of this. The Cambrian explosion does challenge the traditional idea of gradual evolution of animals. Because they all seem to appear all of a sudden, and the problem is, how do we explain it?
Paleontologists have determined that the Chinese fossils were older than those excavated at the Burgess Shale. Yet anatomically, they were often even more complex. This discovery also confirmed that previous estimates of an explosion lasting 20 to 40 million years were much too long.
The time period that we figured it took the animals to be established in the ocean in those days took probably 10 million, 5 million years. So this is truly an explosive event in the scientific terms. What we are seeing is a quantum jump. And this quantum jump has no explanation.
The Cambrian explosion was so short that it is below the resolution of the fossil record. It could have happened overnight. So we don't know the duration of the Cambrian explosion, we just know that it was very, very fast.
The Qinjiang fossils provide the most inclusive picture of the Cambrian explosion yet documented. And directly beneath them, in Precambrian shales, another chapter in the history of life is written in the rocks.
There's another amazing find that's been made in China. Paleobiologists have discovered little tiny microscopic sponge embryos, layers of rock just beneath the layer that documents the Cambrian explosion.
These embryos were soft-bodied animals. Some fossilized 60 million years before the Cambrian explosion.
This is highly significant because one of the most popular explanations for the missing Precambrian fossils is that the Precambrian animals were too soft and too small to have been preserved.
Since 1999, Paul Qian has studied fossil embryos and helped develop techniques to analyze their structure.
By treating with acid, you can actually remove the rock and isolate the embryos, and then you get around pebble-like or sand grain-like samples. And then we look through some tiny little ones, larger ones up to 1 millimeter in size. And then I start breaking up these balls and try to start looking inside. And with the help of the electron microscope, I was able to see the detailed subcell structure within these embryos.
Qian's work on these fragile remnants of Precambrian life raises an important question.
If these lower strata can preserve an embryo, if they can preserve a soft microscopic embryo, then why couldn't they have preserved the larger ancestral forms that supposedly evolved into the Cambrian animals? In other words, if you can preserve something as fragile as an embryo, why couldn't you, in the same strata of rock, preserve the immediate ancestor of a hard-shelled trilobite?
With the Darwinian expectation of an abundance of transitionals. That's what's going to get you a professorship. You find those transitional forms. So all over the world, in countless outcrops, people have been looking for those forms that would capture the major transitions in the history of life.
I think the Cambrian fossil record is surprisingly complete. I think it may be more complete than we realize. The reason for that is, for instance, if you look at the stratigraphy of the world, if I go and collect Cambrian rocks in Wales and find Turton fossils, if I then go to China, I don't find the same species, but I find the same sorts of fossils. If I go into Carboniferous rocks, I go to Canada, they're the same as what I find in this country. So there is a clear set of faunas and floras which take us through geological time. The overall framework is falling into position.
To the paleontologists, the lack of intermediate fossils is well known. Some people still think that if you look long and hard enough, you will eventually find them. But I think most of the paleontologists that I have been in contact would not have that hope very high. They simply feel that we have looked long and hard enough, and that they are not there. They are not there.
It's a defensible statement that most of the major animal body plans are present in the Cambrian explosion. That's where they first appear.
Man. Wow! So, sponge embryos preserved perfectly. You saw the detail when they got in with the electron microscope, but no other fossils. So the excuse that, well, they were there, they just didn't get fossilized. They weren't there. And so we're left with something that demands an explanation, but that explanation can never come from gradualized natural selection and evolution. It perfectly fits the idea of creation, though. I want to qualify this a couple of points here. I'm not saying that natural selection is false, there's no such thing, or evolution. I believe in evolution. I think it explains a lot. All I'm saying is it's insufficient. There has to be something else also. And I believe that that is the Creator God. Yeah. The only source of the intellect, the design that is in these has to be a thinking mind. It's not an unthinking process that would cause that. There are philosophical implications too, but we'll take that up next time, next week. What are the biblically based theories? But I'll get partway into it and we'll just save the rest for next week. This view, progressive creation, holds that what we're reading about in Genesis didn't all happen in 1 week. But it's a sequence that may stretch over millions of years, billions of years even. And that could happen either because the creative events, the days, are not one right after the other, but one, and then a few million years later, another one, and so forth. Or a couple of other possibilities. This is the day-age theory. This says each one of those days is not really a 24-hour day, but it's an age. And we can show that the Hebrew word yom sometimes refers to long periods of time, not just a 24-hour day. So it can be translated differently. Another theory is called the days are literal, but they're not sequential. That's what I just referred to, where God would come and introduce new forms and then go wait. Maybe some millions of years pass, he comes back and does it again. Another wait. I don't find that hard to believe. Day's representative theory says these days not sequential, but they're just a handful of typical days. There are probably many more than this. Thousands, yes. And they just picked out a few to give the general picture. That would be very common in Hebrew writing, like when they do a genealogy, sometimes they'll give the whole thing. Sometimes it's just like picked a few down because you're trying to see the direction things went, not be exhaustive in recording everything that happened. And there's problems with each of these theories. The day, age, all of these, really one of the problems is that the sequence that we read in Genesis 1 is wrong. For instance, it's got flowering, seed-bearing, green plants on land before creation of life in the sea. That's absolutely not right. So some people say, well, it's the order isn't important. I think it is trying to show an order of operations because it's then, da-da-da-da, and morning and evening, the fourth day. Then, da-da-da-da. The gap theory. This is totally different, okay? In this theory, you have original creation, where it says, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth, okay? So the heavens got started about 14.7 billion years ago, the earth much later, 4.5. And then, after several billions of years of change and possibly creative acts mixed with evolution, something happened pretty recently that was like a devastation of the earth. Maybe only 10,000, 9,000 years ago, maybe even less. And that what we're reading in Genesis is not the original creation, but a recreation of many species that had been wiped out. And apparently in a flood, because it says the Spirit, it says, in the beginning, God created, do I have that here? Yeah. Created the heavens and earth. Okay. That's the title of this whole thing. And most of that we're going to ignore. Now in verse 2, now the earth was formless and empty. Go to NIV and they give you the marginal reading and the earth became formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep. That's water. It's a watery destruction. That's quite a different reading, and you can definitely translate the Hebrew that way. It is possible. So, if that's the case, then this event happened, And God then can to come and recreate a bunch, maybe not everything, there could have been survivors, but a lot. And that's what's described for us in Genesis 1. And so the 6 days are actually literally days, one right after the other, probably. And the whole thing might not have even taken a year. It could be very, very short, this happened. Yeah. All of natural history, the 3.8 million years of life that we have, happens before Genesis 1, 2. And it could be anything. I mean, I still think that periodic creative acts are indicated in the fossil record. But even theistic evolution could easily fit into this scenario that all the evolutionary development happened before Genesis 1. The problem is that, again, the problem is with the fossil record. God doesn't discuss the part before this recreation because they didn't need to know about that. This is their story, the Hebrews, and ours. And so you can fit anything you want into that. Progressive creation, yeah. I think very likely. And it could even explain earlier hominids. You know, human-like, genus Homo or Australopithecines that have some human characteristics may have been species living before this gap that happened. And so they're just part of a different story. And then God started over with a new recreation, including humans. Homo sapiens would have been created at this point. Explains the days, the morning and evening language. Fits this perfectly, no problem. And there's also even some other biblical support. In Isaiah, he says, "Thus says the Lord who created the heavens, he is the God who formed the earth and made it. He established it and did not create it a waste place, but formed it to be inhabited." That tohu word for a waste place is the same word that's in Genesis 1 verse 2, where it says the earth became formless and void. Tohu obohu. And here Isaiah is saying from God that I did not create the world that way. It kind of supports the idea that maybe it became that way later. Another one is in 2 Peter 3. Peter, again, working under inspiration from the Holy Spirit, he says they deliberately forget the opponents that he's talking about. That God made the heavens by the word of his command, that he brought the earth out from the water and surrounded it with water, through which the world at that time was destroyed, being flooded with water. Well, some readers are saying, well, that's probably referring to the Genesis flood of Noah. That was thousands of years later. He says, at that time, the world had been destroyed. That could easily be the destruction in Genesis 1. And it actually, that verse perfectly describes what we'd be reading under the so-called gap theory. Remember that. I'm quite taken with it. I mean, we don't know whether that's really the answer, but it sure as hell could be. And it certainly addresses all the problems in a way that the day, age, and some of the others really have struggled with. Okay, I'm going to skip down. We'll do this part next week. I don't like mature creationism. This is kind of the fundamentalist view that the earth is only 6,000 or 10,000 years old. I just think it's really not credible at all. All right, so bottom line, what we're reading in the Bible harmonizes with what we learn in modern science. And it may not harmonize with somebody's given theory of gradualism, but that's really not what we find in the fossil record anyway. So, and that is the important point to people who are scientists or who know a lot of science. Evolution, evident, no problem. But you need something more. That's especially clear when it comes to humans. If you believe that you have a soul, if you believe that you have a mind that's non-material, if you believe that you're not conditioned and forced and determined to do everything you do, that you have free will, that implies that something non-material has been injected into you. That perfectly fits the biblical story of creation. It does not fit atheistic Darwinism. Where would the soul come from? The Darwinism explains material, physical, bodily change, not the introduction of a soul, especially not a soul that survives the death of the body. We're going to talk about that next week. The nature of the human race, everything about us, perfectly explained in this passage coming up. And the biggest, coolest part of all is that God created the world, and it turns out he's really good, very friendly, wants to get to know you, came here and paid a huge price for you to have your sins forgiven, because that's how badly he wants to be together. Getting to know God, meeting him personally, that's something you can ask for. And he will respond to any heart that's eager to know him. We're going to study some more on these next time. I think you'll like it. Oh, God, how fantastic this world is that you've created. And that we would ever think that you didn't do this. It's just it's so obvious. And we also see from this what you must be like. You're not a force. You're not some impersonal pantheistic God. You must be a thinking, planning, purposeful being to explain this. And so we just rejoice in that fact that you really are a personal being, just like we're personal beings, made in your image. We pray that we will just stick with this study, God, and I'm sure that the picture is just going to get more and more clear as we go on, and really get an eyeful of what it means. And we bask it in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.